This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise.
Hey there. I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business Podcast. But when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hey there, brother. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I am excellent. I'm very excited about our guest today.
Oh, my God. I've been braggadociously telling everybody about this episode. So I'm very, very excited as well. Should we just get into it?
I think we must. This time we must. Usually we say we should. This time we must.
This is true. And Adam, you're here, right?
Yeah, I'm here. How are you? Hey, what's up?
All right. All of a sudden, our podcast got a lot better looking. Okay.
Thanks.
Speak for yourself, PJ. Well, I light up the screen, but that's
I okay. Like it. Let's just do this thing for 3 hours, man. Feed my ego. That's great.
By the way, no, I'm just kidding. All right. So, folks, we have today Adam Kinzinger on the Braving Business Podcast. There are moments in life and in business where we find ourselves at a crossroads between comfort and conviction. For our guest today, Adam Kinzinger, that moment came while standing at the heart of American power, watching a slow motion crisis unfold around him. A former U.S. Congressman from Illinois, Adam served in the House of Representatives from 2011 to 2023. A veteran of both U.S. Air Force and Air National Guard, where he still serves as Lieutenant Colonel, Adam was a rising star in Republican politics, but when the foundations of democratic norms began to tremble, culminating for many Americans by the events of January 6, 2021, Adam became one of the very few in his party who put conviction ahead of ambition. His work on the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack put him at the center of one of the most consequential constitutional investigations in modern U.S. history, and in the crosshairs of the MAGA movement that overtook the Republican Party. Now an author, a commentator, and founder of Country First, a movement aiming to depolarize American politics and defend the core principles of the Republic, Adam has made it his mission to call out what he sees as a creeping authoritarianism infecting public life. This conversation is different than most Braving Business episodes. It's not about a company turnaround or a high stakes pivot, but it is absolutely about the choices people in power have and the impact of leadership on norms, values, morals, and even the meaning of truth. Adam Kinzinger, it is truly an absolute honor to welcome you to the Braving Business Podcast.
Thanks. That's really kind. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Adam, thanks for being here. I'm going to try not to be a teenage girl.
Fanboy.
I'm a fan of yours and your work. As we usually do when we start on the podcast, we usually start on people's early days. But in your case, I think the most interesting place to start would be your transition from being in the military to joining Congress as a Republican congressman. You came in with strong party credentials, and you
I believe we're on a pretty traditional path. That the Republican Party of old, Adam Kinzinger, appropriately was a star. When you first got to Washington, what surprised you in a pleasant way about fellow members of Congress? Maybe was different than what you expected?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Honestly, I was surprised, which the irony of it is it's where I'm a little disheartened now, but I was surprised by the authenticity of people. So, you know, I get elected with this giant class of 2010. I mean, there was like 80 some of us. You know, we had professional football player John Runyon. We had a now Secretary of Transportation that was a reality star, Sean Duffy. Christy Noem was in my class. You know, that's this kind of, you know, array of people. And when I got there, I got to know them first. And it was just like, these are genuine folks that really, truly had a passion for the country, which is why they decided to run. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ego involved. We'll be clear about that. But it was the thing where you took your ego to politics is like, I really want to do something. And even the Democrats, you know, and at the beginning, obviously, you're kind of on the other side of the aisle and you're doing a little combat on the floor of the House. But I realized over kind of that first year, the great respect I had with other Democrats who had with me. And you recognize that what we were doing at the time was a job. And you kind of go to understand that you go to DC with your passions, with your convictions, with the interest of your district, and you just do the best you can. And you respect each other outside of that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that has changed, but I think that's what surprised me the most. And then the other thing is just, it never ceased. I mean, even up on January 6th, for God's sakes, it never ceased to kind of take my breath away occasionally, walking into the Capitol of the United States and being like, man, I represent 700,000 people. Me, Adam Kinzinger, 700,000 people. How in the world did I get here? And that's something that never wore off for me. And still, I look back and I'm like, that's crazy. It feels like a dream.
I mean, what you're sharing, I can, as someone that was calling a members of Congress on behalf of a variety of causes I believed in, that was my experience also. I saw a lot of authentic love of country. There is this mindset, I think, and again, things have probably changed quite a bit, but there was always this mindset that members of Congress were in it for themselves. And my own experience was quite different. For the most part, and I met with members of both parties, they were genuinely interested in solutions. That was my experience.
It's true. There is a lot of ego involved. And, you know, look, I never would have run for office if I didn't have an ego, right? Because there's a point at which you say, I'm going to run because I think I can do a great job. I'm going to represent 700,000 people because I think I'm probably the best 700,000 people to do the job. There has to be ego or else you're not going to put yourself through that. But the question is it unhealthy or healthy ego? You know, unhealthy ego says, I'm going to run for office because I want to be famous. And by the way, nowadays, you can be instantly famous tomorrow if you decide to. You just tweet something or say something outrageous. And there's a lot of unhealthy ego in that. Healthy ego says, I really believe I have what it takes to do this. And you're willing to put yourself through that grind. And so, yes, people go there. They care about their press. They care about the way they look in the public eye because it all matters. But when it's all said and done, they're there for the right cause. Again, they were there for the right cause, and I think a lot still are. But that's what really stood out to me is just, you know, in fact, the other day I was I have a plane, I fly, and the guy that was doing my check ride, which I have to do every year, we were having lunch and, you know, older guy, a little bitter, and he was talking about how corrupt politicians are. And I go, well, honestly, dude, I never took a single dollar that was illegal or corrupt. And he winks at me, he goes, no, I know the truth. I mean, you don't have to hoodwink me on this one. Like, basically, I should just, of course I'm corrupt. And the truth is there corruption? Some, I've seen it. Some people get prosecuted, but I wouldn't even know how to be corrupt in the job. And so many people that I think would get tagged with that aren't. And so, you know, I think people should understand that Congress still is of, for, and by the people. And some of that's even being reflected today.
Wow. So, you know, you talked about ego, you talked about putting yourself out there. Let's talk about fear. So not so much about danger, but fear of irrelevance, of losing your seat, of putting your ego out there and then not, you know, holding that high position anymore. From what you saw, how much does fear shape the choices that our elected officials make or avoid making?
It's like 1,000,000%. I mean, look, when I ran, first off, there was fear in running, and I suffered from imposter syndrome. And it took me 6 months after I was a declared candidate to quit giggling when I told people, because I'm like, yeah, I was 31 years old, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm running for Congress. I'd kind of laugh and chuckle, like, who the hell do I think I am? And so there was a fear that you overcame there. You know, your time in politics, there's always a fear of irrelevance, or you could do something. Or then who knows what news story is going to come out about you? That's a thing you live with every day. But when it comes to making like a tough decision, I mean, look, I think people fear more than they fear death. Okay. They fear losing their identity, or they fear getting kicked out of a tribe. And you think about that just evolutionarily, right? Tribes are so important for us to survive. If you got kicked out of a tribe in the caveman days, you're dead in 40 minutes. Saber-toothed tiger will eat you and your family. And so this idea of kind of standing up, being kicked out of your tribe and isolated, it's frightening to a lot of people. It was frightening to me, by the way. It's only once you actually take that step and you actually overcome that fear that the fear doesn't go away, but you realize it's doable. But I think 9 out of 10 adults, you know, would step in front of a train to save a kid and die in the process. So is there a fear of death? Yes, nobody wants to die, but I think the vast majority of people would do that. What I've come to learn is the vast majority of people, at least put in a position to do it in politics, you know, that would lose their identity, this thing that you've built your whole self around. I'm a U.S. congressman, I'm a politician, I'm important. Or I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, and my entire social circle is built on that. That's the thing that I think holds people paralyzed in fear. And I'll also say, and this is universal for every politician, because we talk about this all the time. When you go through the thought process of, I might not run again, okay? Maybe I'm not going to run again after this term. The thing that you fear the most in that is actually, it's kind of funny, but it's that the second the press release goes out, you regret it. But it's too late. I mean, it's not the fear isn't like, hey, I don't know if I'm going to get a job. I don't know. It's like, I'm scared that I'm going to put out that press release and immediately regret it and not be able to take it back. So fear has a huge grip on people, particularly people, you know, that have to rely on other people with fear to put them in the position they're in. Everybody has fears, including 700,000 people I represent. So we got to manage that and manage my fear on top of that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's very consistent with what we've heard on this podcast. And we've interviewed, you know, billionaires and very, very successful entrepreneurs and actors and musicians and athletes. And consistently, fear comes up as something that is there. It's present. And the more you have to lose, the likely it is that fear takes an even bigger place in your mind.
You know,
and there's a reason that, you know, if you look at the Bible, regardless of whether you believe it or you don't believe it, you can at least call it a great piece of philosophy. And one of the things that is warned about the most in there is fear. And you know, what is it that the words of God talk about more than anything? Fear. Like, fear not. Like, don't. And when you realize if you can actually remove fear, I mean, there is healthy fear, let's be clear. You know, you don't want to walk in front of a train if you don't have to. But when you remove that paralyzing fear, it's like, then you can operate. My favorite line in any show or movie ever is in Band of Brothers. There's this scene where Lieutenant Spears, who's this kind of guy who just basically, you know, he has this lore of killing prisoners, even though he didn't do it. But he's this kind of badass that everybody's looking at. He goes to this guy, Private Spleith or something, whatever his name is. He's in, and he's scared to death. He's frozen in combat. And Lieutenant Spears looks at him and goes, you know your problem? It's Blythe. He goes, you know your problem, Private Blythe? You have hope. He goes, that's your problem. The sooner you recognize that you're already dead, the better you can operate in war. All war depends on it. And that's the point, is the sooner you can put the worst case scenario out there and confront it, then you can operate as a politician, as a military person, as a business leader, once you overcome that fear.
It's super interesting. Real quick.
Go ahead, PJ.
I'm sorry. One thing, you know, looking back in history, I think one of the biggest drivers in society has changed, or at least has changed in politics from what I can see. And that driver used to be shame. There used to be a lot of shame where you took accountability and you were deathly afraid of doing anything wrong to be kicked out of the tribe, right? This is historical. And now there doesn't seem to be that shame. If you can mess up, You can do things illegally. You can get caught red-handed doing something terrible. And yet now it just seems like politicians just want to lie through it and they want to just bluster through it. And, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I was doing a TV hit the other day and a politician was talking and I said right after that, I go, you realize we all know watching that clip that we just watched, we all know they're lying, but it's just natural now to lie. And it's like, we've become so tribal again that if you just double down on a lie, but at least as long as your tribe buys it and all agrees that this is going to be the line we agree on, then that works. I'll go one step further and say shame hasn't really disappeared in politics. It's transferred, and it's transferred to, I mean, I dealt with this. I felt shame going against my party, right? I never changed what I believed. I mean, over time, I've matured. I was always kind of a moderate Republican. You know, there are things that I've kind of come as I get older and I become a parent that I've changed on a little bit. But like, I'm pretty recognizable Adam Kinzinger of 2011, what I believe then to what I believe today. But I had to deal with a real sense of shame when I turned against my party. Every day I would wake up, and this still happens some, and be like, am I wrong? And then it only takes me a half second to be like, no, you know, I know what I believe. I know this is right. But that's something you battle with every day. And look, my co-pilot in Iraq, I'm not saying this for sympathy, but it's just a fact. My co-pilot in Iraq, who I fought with, sent me a text in the middle of the January 6th stuff and said, I'm ashamed to have ever known you and ashamed to have ever flown with you. I had my extended family, you know, and they sent a copy to the New York Times, which is the only reason it was a national news story, sent a letter to me certified, which I didn't know you could still do, disowning me. Happened to be a day I was at my parents. I sent it to my parents' house. That's the kind of shame I felt. And we should not live in a place where people feel shame because they think they're doing the right thing. Even if you disagree with what I did, I understand it. People are on all sides of this stuff. But I didn't do it because this was fun. I didn't do it because I wanted to win favor with Democrats. I already had enough favor with Republicans at the time. But yeah, it's kind of a perverse shame now in a way.
So yeah, it's interesting that shame is the setup for my next question, because you had already served several terms when Donald Trump arrived on the scene, you know, walked down the golden escalators. What did you see both inside Congress and among voters that helped you realize this isn't business as usual? Something here is really shifting.
Look, I could take an hour pointing out different moments that like things struck me, but I'll just put this at the 50,000 foot view. Obvious, I was a Jeb Bush guy. I thought I'd end up in the cabinet or something because I was an early Jeb adopter, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember his card. Remember Jeb was an exclamation mark.
yeah, Jeb just, exclamation point.
Shout it. Right.
So much energy. But, you know, Trump comes along and we're in denial the whole time. And I mean, the people that are in denial are the people that are like his biggest cheerleaders now, which is interesting. And he just maintained a 20% and outlasted everybody. And then eventually he kind of caught fire. The thing that really, you know, look, I was never eager to support him. The thing that I didn't support him in 2016. The thing that did that was I'm at the Republican National Convention. And it's a really weird feeling, by the way. I mean, the typical kind of Republicans you see, they've been replaced. Okay. So it's just, I'll just say that. And you're like, well, these are different people than usual. That's great. It's grassroots energy. But when he removed the Russia thing from the platform at the behest of Manafort, that's when I'm like, oh, hang on. This is a real problem. And so I saw that as the beginning of kind of adopting what to this point was a really kind of fringe element of the GOP, which is like Russia's good. And I saw that now start to get mainstreamed. I'll be honest, kind of Trump's first term in comparison to today, and especially the first 2 years, seems like a normal presidency. He kind of got in, put normal people around him. Second half of the term was a little unmoored. But I started to see Donald Trump peddling anger and division. And one of the things I've always thought when it comes to leadership and when it comes to the presidents particularly is you play with fire. So, you know, there's that mine in, I don't know, Ohio or Pennsylvania that's been on fire for like 50 years. And like every now and then they punch the hole in the earth and the fire comes up. that's kind of like leadership. Like sometimes you have to stoke fear. You stoke maybe a little division, you know, to get to something, but you know to keep it contained. And Donald Trump decided not to keep this fire contained. And what concerned me is it wasn't just him. I started to see the copycats in my own party, the people that I respected. And that's when I realized, like, look, when you have somebody, I'll get esoteric for a second. Everybody has a battle in their heart every day between light and dark. And some days the darkness wins. But when somebody with authority speaks the dark parts of your heart to you, it gives you permission to let that overtake you. And letting the darkness overtake you, by the way, is really easy. It's really easy. And I started to watch that happen. And that to me is when I started to get really concerned. And the last point is that culminated in a major way election night 2020 when he said the election was stolen. And I can save that. But that's when I'm like, oh, now we're in a real dark place.
And, you know, for many people, the 4 years of Trump 1.0 were harrowing. I can tell you that I was in a constant state of anxiety. And then I spent the subsequent 4 years not watching the news as often, which was different for me. I still read the New York Times every day and the Wall Street Journal every day, but I wasn't consuming news the way I had been under Trump 1.0. And there is a clear change. Trump 2.0, and I know you've been talking a lot about authoritarianism, and I think PJ is going there with his question, but Trump 2.0 is acting out some things that I think we all believed he believed or wanted to do, but was curtailed by, as you said, he pretty much had a normal cabinet, particularly the front end of Trump 1.0. I saw what you are talking about, you know, from the cheap seats, and was wondering, you know, where would this end? And here we are at Trump 2.0, and it's still not clear where it's going to end.
Yeah. I mean, look, I will say this. It is worse today than I imagined the worst case scenario in January. And I think the worst part about it is it's you know, less what Trump is doing, although it's bad in my mind, because I'm a small government Republican still. And somehow Republicanism became now big government, right? And it became in your face, in your lives. But like the thing that concerns me more than anything that I never saw was the lack of institutional pushback. You know, corporations that are fearful now, to an extent, I can understand that. You have a board, you have shareholders. I wish it wasn't the case, but it is. Academic institutions. I mean, what? Who saw this coming? Law firms. Who saw? I mean, look, you can challenge Trump in court and you have free lawyers to do it. You're a law firm, right? That's the stuff that has concerned me. And you know, I hear in authoritarian countries, I'd heard somebody interviewed talking specifically about under Orban, and they say what happens is, you know, your life doesn't change really if you don't want it to. You just go from seeing the big picture, like caring about government, caring about other things, and you just make your world small. It's just, I have to go to work, make money, provide for my children. I'm not going to pay attention to anything over here because, you know, that I don't want to get involved. And when people start making their world small, that's concerning. And, you know, and Trump 1.0, Trump could have done whatever he wanted, but he's like on the highway, hits the rumble strips. There's noise. He kind of thinks about it, makes a decision back onto the highway. The rumble strips have been erased. Everybody around him has basically had to commit to never telling him no and never telling him he's wrong. And listen, regardless of your feelings of him, you've got to admit that any leader with people around him that are committed to saying yes is a bad leader, period. You could be Jesus Christ or Abraham Lincoln. If you have only yes men around you, it's not a recipe for good things.
So true. So let's talk about a little bit of the psychology of authoritarianism, or at least the manipulation of words, right? So supporters of the current the president say warnings about authoritarianism are just fear tactics. They say that he's using the tools of government just like Democrats did. He's just willing to fight back. What would you say to those defenders, those people saying that?
I mean, look, let's look at what Democrats have done. And part of the reason there's this perception that Democrats were authoritarian or they've overstepped was because you think about for 30 years, there's been this honestly, right-wing media culture that has created this idea that Democrats, I mean, how do you get to a point where a significant number of people believe Democrats literally bleed babies out and inject their blood?
It's ridiculous.
I mean, people believe that. Well, you know, for 30 years, you convince people that Democrats are legitimately evil, like possessed by Satan evil, right? And so, you know, look, I think you got to hit me with your question again. I literally just lost my train of thought on that. Do it. Go.
When they're saying that he's using the tools of government, just like
that's it. The authoritarian.
Yes, sir.
I was like talking. I'm like, oh, crap. but so you look at this, you know, culture that's kind of educating them. So every time, you know, Obama, for instance, would do a executive order, they would say, look at that authoritarianism. He's going around Congress. Yeah, executive orders are legal and they're being leaned on, particularly by Donald Trump as well. But you know what the Democrats never did? They never ignored a court order. They never had so many of their things challenged in court legitimately. They never made attempts to go around the 14th Amendment, for instance, birthright citizenship. They never scooped Americans off the street. They never went to law firms and said, you have to write us a check or agree to X amount of pro bono so that we don't use the instruments of government to come after you. They never did that to private organizations. And so you can look and say, well, is what Donald Trump's doing technically authoritarian? I think so. But if you want to say no, that's fine. But then let's look at authoritarian countries like Hungary and say, how did Orban get to the position he's in? And it's the exact marching order, except it's happening a lot faster of what we're seeing here. So I get it. You may not love what the Democrats have done. You may not love their policies. You may think, you know, Obama was arrogant. You may have thought Biden was arrogant. I got it. Okay. But there's a difference between arrogance and disagreements and then using the instruments of states to suppress beliefs, suppress thoughts. And by the way, I do not remember any Democrat putting 700 Marines and 4,000 federal army troops, because by the way, when you activate National Guard under Title 10, so under presidential authority, they are now federal troops, same as the 82nd Airborne. I do not remember anybody doing that and putting them on the streets of LA when there was you could argue a riot that LAPD had well in hand. That's meant to intimidate, and the intimidation is the authoritarianism. Are we Adolf Hitler? No. But are we getting to the point where the instruments of the state are used to intimidate people? Undoubtedly. And I don't think anybody with a straight face on CIA truth serum, no matter how much they love the Republican Party right now, would say otherwise.
And part of that is also the breakdown of norms. And, you know, there's this belief that political norms are just soft power tools for elites who don't want to be challenged. I've heard people who I respect say Trump's breaking the system because the system needs breaking.
Right.
what's your argument that certain norms aren't just elite preferences? They're moral guardrails.
Yeah, it's interesting. I argue sometimes that we are a victim of our own success. Mm. You know, humans, not Americans, humans love drama. And, you know, we've been comfortable. I mean, yes, there's huge issues with income inequality, healthcare. We can go down the line on that. But generally, historically speaking, we're pretty comfortable here. And so, you know, we had the Soviet Union we were united against until the 90s. Then we had basically terrorism we were united against. And now we have a guy that's actually united us all against each other. And so this idea of we need to come in and just blow up the system and break it sounds great, because we do have income inequality, because we do have too many people that go without healthcare, because, you know, we do have a $40 trillion debt. So it feels like we need to blow up the system. The problem is, the system is the reason that you and I are alive and are able to buy clothes and are protected, because the system, as flawed as it is, and it's flawed, has kept us safe. It's kept us able to drive on roads. It's allowed businesses to form and thrive. It's allowed the healthcare industry, even though there's an issue with payment, to be, frankly, the best quality healthcare in the world. So yeah, you can bring somebody in to fix the system, but the second you blow up norms, you never give them back. And it becomes, and the second you, let me use the example here. It's baseball. So let's say you're in Chicago, you're watching the Cubs play. It's Cubs against Cardinals. And the Cubs make a decision that when they hit the ball, they're just going to run to third base and then home. And the Cardinals like, well, you can't do that. The rules say you have to go to first. And the Cubs say, listen, you're on our territory. You know, we own the umpires. We're just going to say third and then home, and we're going to count it. We're going to put that run up on the scoreboard. What does that do? Well, technically, yeah, the Cubs could do that. They could count that as a score, but you go out of the rules to play the game. And when you go out of the rules to play the game's over. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no game that can be played. And in democracy, when you break the rules and you start to say things like, you know, we're going to get rid of the filibuster, or we're going to pack the courts. Like, you know, I don't love where the Supreme Court is right now. I don't think we should pack it. I do think we should have term limits on it, by the way. Or you say things like, yeah, whatever it is, whatever norm, you know, Texas, I'm sitting in Texas right now. We're going to have a mid-cycle redistricting just to squeeze five more people out. Well, now you become power politics and you're basically creating a game where you run to third. And I'm going to tell you, democracy particularly only thrives when we all agree to the rules. If you have an authoritarian, you don't have to agree on the rules because it's whatever he wants. If you have self-governance, you have to agree to the rules or else, you know, because there's nobody in charge. We're in charge.
So, speaking of rules, what about civil service, right? We're supposed to understand the country operates under the laws of civics and this, the Constitution and these great, checks and balances that we put in place. There is real support for replacing, just as you said, term limits, career bureaucrats with loyalists, especially among voters who believe that deep state undermines elected leaders. How do you draw the line between healthy executive control and outright politicization, politicization, whatever, of the civil service?
Yeah, look, I basically believe that a president should have a lot of authority when it comes to foreign policy. The Constitution's pretty clear about that. I think Congress is completely incapable of conducting detailed foreign policy in a, you know, in the speed of light like we have to nowadays. Other than that, the president's job is to execute the laws, not to create the laws, not to make them. It's to execute the judiciary's will. I mean, this is what the founders intended. You know, hey, there's going to be this group of laws. We got to have one person on top that makes sure this is done. And so, yes, there has to be some areas where you can put political loyalists in because you want to make sure that a president can have influence in his or her administration. But when you wipe out the civil service like they're doing right now, you do two things. Number one, what is it that every Republican claims they want? And frankly, every Democrat would agree. We want efficiency in government. We want government to be efficient. When you get rid of experience in government and you replace somebody that's been doing, you know, working on Social Security systems for 15 years with a 22-year-old named Big Balls, or, you know, a 21-year-old with an arched eyebrow that's now in charge of counterterrorism in the United States, I got to tell you, you now don't have competency in government. What you have now is a reward system for political loyalty, but government becomes what it was before the Civil Service Act was put into place, which was inefficient and rife with corruption. And so I want to maintain the good number of people that we have that are doing this because government doesn't pay well, it has good benefits. So it takes people a lot of sacrifice sometimes to work for government, but they believe in it. And you also have to have consistency. When somebody takes over after Donald Trump, you don't want a completely vacant federal government. You want this government to continue because all you're doing technically is switching people on top of it to make sure it's effective. So I think this is a huge mistake. Look, I will agree there had to be some fixes in civil service and the president should have some authority over some of that. But what they've done has gone way too out of control. And this is just clearly Project 2025 under a different name.
And just like civil service, which I agree with you on, I have members of my family who work for the federal government and they are reporting morale is at an all-time low. People are afraid to speak their mind. We saw what just happened to the leader of the bureau that released statistics on employment numbers being dismissed because the numbers were poor. That simply, to me, it boils down to people not appreciating that what's made America great is America's predictability, that you could count on the American system of government with all its flaws to operate generally speaking, in an honorable, consistent way. And much the same way, I think, on immigration, and I happen to be an immigrant. I actually came to this country at the age of 12. I was an undocumented immigrant. My father was an engineer, worked in construction. My mother was a PhD in education. She works as a teacher's aide. They worked to the bone, three jobs each, to allow me and my brothers the opportunity to have a better life. And I've been incredibly blessed to be part of this country. And so particularly seeing the lack of compassion that's currently masquerading as policy has been very tough on me. But some people on the right say that compassion is what got us into this mess, that being tough is the only way to deter chaos at the border. And by the way, like most immigrants who came to this country illegally, I came by plane. I didn't walk across any border. And I came in 1986, and it was Ronald Reagan who was president. And at the time, I was given a free school lunch, and I could go to a clinic when I was sick because we had that kind of compassion under President Reagan. But I'd love to get your thoughts on the belief that cruelty, or maybe they consider it deterrence, it's hard to not see it as cruelty, is a necessary tool of immigration policy. What would you say to people that are arguing that, you know, the cruelty is actually part of the plan? We need to scare people away from coming to the United States.
I mean, it makes me sick, I'll be honest with you. You know, look, here's the thing about immigration. This is a country, unlike most countries, that has been built with a legacy of immigration. I mean, the reason that our economy is as strong as it is, which we're trying to protect, the reason that, you know, frankly, the reason that our manufacturing system is so strong is because it was destroyed around the world in World War II, and we inherited the manufacturing as well as, you know, many people that immigrated from war-torn countries and came with their energy. We are not growing at the rate we need to grow. What's always interesting to me is people that are claimed to be China hawks and also immigration hawks. You can't compete with China when you're growing under what's necessary to grow population-wise if you're not making up that delta with immigration. But the other thing is, it's just like, what's it saying about our soul? Here's the thing. I'll be quite honest with you. If this was unrestricted immigration from Ireland or Germany, or as the president has said in the past, Scandinavia, I don't think there'd be this anger about it. It's because it's brown people, let's be honest. Let's be clear about that, right? Now, that doesn't mean everybody that's an immigration hawk is doing it because it's brown people, but I think that's what's driving this. And so all of us believe in a strong border. There's not a Democrat or Republican, I think, that doesn't believe in a strong border. Maybe there's a few out there. But the idea that we're going to then deport people here who aren't just criminals, who have lived here for 20 or 30 years, we're going to put them in a place called Alligator Alcatraz, okay? And then we're going to, you know, or deport them to CECOT, which is a prison that does not follow anything to do with, you know, Red Cross or whatever. It's a black hole. I mean, look, it's just evil, period, for human beings. But it is a reflection and a stain on our country. We have shame, or we should have shame, from interning the Japanese people in World War II. 100%. I have a hard time seeing how this is much different. We are picking up people and putting them in a camp based on how they look. I don't have to worry about getting pulled over in Texas and asked for my citizenship papers. My wife, who's Salvadorian, but she was born an American citizen, may have to worry about that a little bit. And that's racist, and it shouldn't be like that in this country. And we will rue the day when we went from immigration hawks, which is fine, to immigration cruelty. You know, cruelty doesn't keep people away. It just stains our soul, I think.
Well said. Well said. My wife is half Japanese. Her grandparents met in the internment camp.
Wow.
So it's unfortunately, that's an American story, right?
It is.
So
it is.
It's kind of nuts.
And now we got a new story we're building that's going to be just as shameful, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And no warm feelings coming from that story as well. So that's unfortunate. I want to talk about you. So, I'm a believer in mottos, right? And my personal motto has always been, you are what you do and it counts. And there's a billion ways of saying that, but it's kind of simple, but that's what I believe. This is the Braving Business podcast, where we talk about people showing resiliency and bravery and things. watching what happened on January 6th was one of the worst moments of my adult life as a citizen, right? It first was obviously September 11th and then January 6th. And watching you go through all of that and stand up against real, real odds and putting your own political life on the line and everything like that, I just want to say, I'm so proud of you and thanks. you did the right thing. So
thank you.
You have been attacked and you've been disowned. You've been threatened. Your wife, your life, your kids have been threatened, right? This is not, this isn't a fantasy or anything. This is real. What have you learned about the human cost of dissent and the personal line between being brave and doing what's right and personal burnout? Like, how do you, what have you learned from that?
You know, look, you talked about my son, and I remember one specific call, a message that was left in my office that said, I hope, it used a Bible verse and then said, I hope your 6-month-old at the time son wanders out into traffic and gets hit by a car.
Jesus.
And that's not even the worst thing I'd heard, right? You know, threats of rape against my wife, going to line the three of you up and kill you, you know, this kind of stuff from people that claim to be Christian, by the way, which is interesting. Here's what I've learned in all that. So, you know, I wear on my wrist the name of Andreas O'Keefe. He's a friend of mine that was killed in Iraq in 2018. And when I came out of Iraq in 2009 and then basically announced for Congress. And I remember when I announced, I said, you know, if I'm going to be willing to vote to send people into war, or I'm going to vote to, you know, outfit people to war, if we're going to ask 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to literally give their life for this country, I have to be willing to give my career for the country if I'm called upon to do it. Mm. Now, honest to God, I thought it would be like I'd have to vote for Social Security reform or something, and that would cost me my job. But, I never imagined it would be this. But that always stuck with me, which is, look, Andreas O'Keefe died. He was like mid-30s. It's the end of his story. It's the end of his movie. It's the end of his life. Who the hell am I to then say, yeah, I know I need to stand up against January 6th or do the right thing, but, you know, this job is comfortable, and I really want to make $174,000 a year. I don't have a right to do that. Oh, and if I did that, I didn't have a right to go and visit any flag-draped coffin of any young person coming back that had been killed. And that just stuck with me. What have I learned from this process is there is a reason, what is it? Profiles in Courage is a thin book, right? You know, we read about, and I'm not putting myself in this league whatsoever, but we read about like Winston Churchill and we read like, boy, that guy, amazing. Great dude. We forget that for 20 or 30 years, he was in the wilderness. He was mocked. He was ridiculed. And he had his moment where he came back. But you realize that standing alone, and I'll say this to anybody in business, in your church or synagogue, in politics, when you actually have that moment to stand alone, it very rarely comes, by the way. When it does, most people don't actually take it. If you take it, it's going to cost you a lot, but I will honestly say this. I can look at myself in the mirror. When I talk to my 3.5-year-old someday about what telling the truth means, or what, you know, what it means to actually stand up and do the right thing, I can tell that to him with a straight face. I can tell that to him without this fear that he's going to Google my name on the internet and then say, you know, how can you talk to me about this when you didn't have courage? And that's the kind of thing that stood with me. So I will say it's when you stand alone that they're the proudest moments, but it's going to cost you because there's, you don't get to that without having to walk through some, you know, some alligators and sharks. And I'm still walking through those.
Wow.
Well, what a great moment. I would put you in the company of great humans in history, actually. The work you're doing now with Country First has been inspiring to me. I've joined the movement.
Awesome.
And I've spoken to people about it, and the there are people who are so beat down. People feel so powerless right now. Even those who agree with your warnings, maybe even particularly they. What would you say? What's the first move for someone who wants to help, but doesn't really know where to start?
Listen, take that burden that you're carrying on your shoulders to save the world and drop it. Right? Here's the thing. We all feel like, and I fight this every day, by the way. I mean, there's not a day that goes by I don't fight like 20 minutes of hopelessness, okay? Just being real. But we all kind of have this thing of we got to do one more tweet or we got to do one more thing. And if we don't do it, this thing's going to fall apart. Well, it's not true. The reality is the thing that could make this whole democracy or this whole experiment, which, by the way, next year is the 250th anniversary. And we're going to be the generation this fails on? Hell no. Right? My grandfather stared down the Nazis in World War II, and I'm going to tell him that it's too hard now. It's all of a sudden too hard because I can't read Twitter anymore, and there's too much news. He lost his mental health on the battlefield, right? Think about the people that ran into the towers on 9/11. Tell them that we just are kind of sick of doing politics now, so America's over. This is what I have to remind myself of. That burden that we carry, you got to drop it and recognize we're all in this together. My biggest message to people is this is not a left versus right battle. It's not. This is the sane right, the center and the left that are uniting against authoritarianism. It's an awkward alliance, but it's a fun alliance because whenever are you going to fight with, on behalf of these people that you don't have anything in common with? So take that burden off your shoulder. Take a deep breath. Make sure if you need to take a week off the news, take a week off the news, because the biggest battle we're up against is discouragement. Because when you get discouraged, it's one less person in the fight. The other side gets energized by this chaos. By the way, they love it. And really what we're looking for is in a year and a half, what happens in those elections and the elections in 3.5 years. I wish there was a magic bullet, something in the Constitution that we forgot about that we could do right now to stop in this mid-cycle. There isn't, right? But we can protest. We can be loud. We can hit the streets. We can demand town halls. And ultimately, we can stay engaged and encouraged. And that's what we need to do. Because listen, again, it bears repeating. I am refusing, and I hope you all do, to be the generation that like puts out the flame because we're exhausted. There's a lot of generations that did a lot of exhausting stuff that passed a stronger flame on to the next generation, and that's what we have to do.
So I wholeheartedly agree with you. In fact, right after this podcast, I'm going to an event to meet a candidate for Attorney General of the state of Florida.
Right.
I'm staying engaged, but there's a lot of angst and anxiety. And even what you spoke of, the elections in 2026, we're seeing what's happening in Texas right now, the attempt to create 5 seats out of thin air in the middle of, in the middle of a decade. Mm-hmm. It feels like some people are not going to play fair.
Yeah.
And that creates a sense that we're up against something greater than we've ever been up against within this country. And to people who would say, Adam, you're great. Your views are right. There are in fact tens of millions of Americans that agree with you. But tribalism is just too entrenched. What's the strongest evidence you've seen that Americans do want character and to restore a version of America that's greater than where we are now? And it's in a way, saying restore is kind of like make America great again. In a funny way, We need to make America great again.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
Look, I think the best evidence that exists is the fact that 55% of Americans feel politically homeless. You're not going to feel politically homeless if one of the two parties is really capturing who you are and what you believe. It's the hat, right? There are people, look, we are stuck in a situation where there are two parties. I would love there to be a centrist party. It's probably not going to happen realistically anytime soon. So the question is, it's not the Republicans, are the Democrats willing to be the big tent party? And this is kind of a conversation Democrats are having with themselves right now. You can either be pure, right? Pure to whatever, whoever's theory of purity on the left is, or you can be a big tent that wins and have your disagreements within the tent. Because if you're having disagreements on whatever issues you're fighting about, guns or whatever, you've won the battle against authoritarianism. And so, yeah, the greatest evidence I see is, look, people only know, and the crazy thing is kids under the age of like 30 don't really know politics before Donald Trump and before this kind of stuff. But we know what it could be. And when I talk about honor and decency and truth and calmness and the fact that the president of the United States should not be on your news feed every day, the people I talk to, at least anecdotally, all shake their head yes in full agreement because they feel something is wrong and broken. And the thing I'm going to tell you, the good thing is we never saw Donald Trump coming because there was this wave building that nobody noticed until it was over. It's the same thing right now with a heal the system wave. I think people are desperate for it. And when the right person comes along and grabs that wave, I think it's going to be overwhelming and we will find ourselves in a much better place. Doesn't mean division is going to go away forever. Doesn't mean we're all going to sing kumbaya around the fire. But I think it means that we can kind of get back to where we know how to do democracy again.
So clearly you're talking about Elon's new party.
Yeah, right. Listen, man, I was actually like, okay, it'll be interesting to see what Elon does. And then like he said, this very, although now it makes sense, but he's like, The thing we're focused on is the Epstein files. And I'm like, okay, Epstein files are important, but we actually need to focus on other things too. And and look, you can't build a party around a person, right? The Republicans will know that they will feel this. When Donald Trump is no longer in the picture, they're gonna be in full civil war with each other. It happens with every party in any country that's based around a personality. Look at the country of Georgia right now. All of this stuff. So yeah, it's, you can't build a party around a person. And the last thing I'll say on that, a centrist party, a moderate is not that you're in the middle on issues. It's not that you're a squish on issues. It's that you don't fall completely into line with one side or the other. That's what moderate is. And I think the vast majority of people in this country are actually moderate.
Agreed. Agreed. So mm-hmm. I can't wait for, you know, Country First to actually be a large political party so I can vote for it. That would be,
there you go. There you go.
That would be amazing.
Got some work to do, but we'll get there.
So, well, hey, you got two people here who will, gladly be on staff. So,
perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
So let's pretend, you know, you kind of intimated about post Trump, which cannot wait. Let's pretend you have a crystal ball. How does this current presidency end? Hopefully not the same way it did last time.
Yeah. Look, I think there's two things. First off, it will end. These people that are, he's never going to get out of power. He's going to run for a third term. As pessimistic as I can be with some of the things I've seen, I don't believe that's the case. And the Constitution's very clear. Donald Trump's 79 years old. They are trolling you with that. That's all a troll. I mean, 90% of what he says is just to get a rise out of the left. So he is going to be done. Now, the question is, what smoking rubble is left in the wake of that? What does the Republican Party look like after that? And that I don't know. I think, you know, I used to believe there would then be a fight in the GOP between kind of the old GOP and this nationalistic thing, and that may happen. But I also think you could see parties of the nationalistic wing, J.D. Vance's against Marco Rubio, who is one now. He's not what he used to be, you know, or Don Jr. You're going to have these personalities that come up and try to inherit the MAGA movement. Now, here's the good news. None of them are capable of doing it. Donald Trump is uniquely capable to do what he did. His shamelessness is something that only exists among him. His kind of swagger is something that people only see in him. Nobody's going to inherit that. So what is my prediction? Kind of a full civil war within the GOP. And I really believe in 10 years, there's not going to be a single person that ever admits they were a Donald Trump supporter. That's what I believed.
So let's end with a question about, I mean, you talked about the fact that 55% of Americans feel politically homeless, and I will count myself among them. I'm someone that has voted pretty much straight Democrat my entire adult life. It's very likely that I will vote for Democrats because I don't really see alternatives at this point. And I think that keeping Donald Trump in check as best we can is the critical goal of the moment. But the Democrats overreached on a number of issues.
They did.
And brought some of this on themselves, including, as was reported in the book that was recently published, potentially cover up the actual decline of Joe Biden. What do you say to someone like me who doesn't know where to turn? Yeah. I know that what I'm looking at in this president and what has become of the Republican Party is nothing I could ever support. I pray that somehow, some way, there is that moment of have you no shame, like we had in the McCarthy era, maybe breaking the spell. But there hasn't happened yet. And it's hard to see at this point what possibly could do it. What do you say to me to give me hope? Something that's grounded in reality, not fantasy. Why should we still believe in the promise of this country to be a shining city on the hill?
Well, I can't give you a good reason to believe except to point to 249 years of American history where, you know, we've had a civil war. You know, we had segregation. We had slavery. You know, we've been through pandemics. We've been through world wars, and we've always come back stronger. And so if you believe that for the first time in 249 years, this will be the thing that takes us down, then I can't give you much hope. And it could be. Let's be clear. I'm not sitting here saying there's no chance this isn't the thing that takes us down. But I also know history as a guide says that we will come through this. There have been terrible moments in American history. The 1920s were pretty terrible. The Ku Klux Klan was on a massive rise. And what happened is communities got together, and that's where you saw an advent of things like Kiwanis. I'm not sure if it was actually Kiwanis, but a lot of these like kind of local groups came out of that moment where people felt disaffected. But I can't sit here and pump you up on false hope except to say that you have as much control at the future of this country as anybody, and you need to stay engaged and use that. I will agree with you. The Democrats have to come to grips with the fact that they lost the trust of the American people. On the Joe Biden stuff, they lost the trust of the American people. They went too far left, I do believe. And by the way, can you guys just stop with the words? Quit inventing words and quit saying that some words are bad. It's a waste of time. And the people that are offended by it end up being white liberals usually and not the actual people that the word is about. So just stop with the words and start looking at people like, The Democrats are losing union members. Like, I was always a Republican supported by the unions. Unions should be voting Democratic. So talk about the working class again. You know, find your roots, Democrats, and have a good time with it. Have a good time finding your roots and loving America and being proud of America. So the advice I give you is, I don't know, I can't pump you up with false hope. I can tell you that history looks pretty good. And ultimately, you have as much control as I do over that.
Amazing. We're about to end. Adam, I just wanted to tell you, just from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Right?
Thanks.
You're one of the rare people that I have seen in politics during at least the last 20 years or so where I can say that is a true patriot. And you have stood as a bulwark against some pretty crappy tides. And I'm very appreciative of you and everything you've done. You wear your heart on your sleeve. The fact that you teared up just talking about your son, it doesn't matter. That's a human thing. That's not a political thing. And, you know, you've gone through it and you've done it for us. And I just want to say from the bottom of my heart and from my family, you know, thank you so much for just trying to keep sanity in this very crazy world, right?
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
No, of course. And also, like, you've built Country First. Let's hear really quick about all your socials. How do people donate? How do people get involved? How do they reach out to you? What can we do?
Yeah, so Country First is country1st.com. So go there, check out all the programs we have, some pretty good stuff. I've got a Substack I write on daily, so do that.
It's awesome,
obviously,
by the way.
I have the Twitter, the Blue Sky, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. And YouTube. I started YouTube. Now I have 100,000 subscribers, so it's good. It's going. Follow me on YouTube, please. I want to hit 200,000. There you go.
Great. So for those of you watching this episode on YouTube, go look at Adam in YouTube and subscribe. I want to echo what PJ said and maybe just add this. You know, this podcast is about doing the right thing. You know, we don't glamorize success. We glamorize kindness, good leadership, good morals, good values, leading with authenticity. And no matter what we see on the national stage right now from our president and the people that follow him, I still believe that that is leadership. Leadership is being willing to take hard choices, even if they're not popular. Doing what you believe is right, not just right this second, but for the long term. And Adam, you embody that. And the actions you've taken while in Congress, since you've left Congress, they're inspiring. And to someone like me, who, you know, again, came to this country as an undocumented and feels more love for the American dream and more commitment to the American experience than maybe a lot of Americans do. I pray that you and the kind of leadership you bring resurfaces as what this country values in its leaders. The day that happens, or the sooner that happens, the better our chances of seeing year 300 of this experiment. Right now, if you know, if I had to take truth serum, if I had to tell you whether I felt like we'd see the next 50 years as the same United States, gosh, I'd say it's a 50-50 call. But I sure hope that people like you lead us out of the wilderness. Adam Kinzinger, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
It was great. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.